You are listening to We Saw the Devil, an investigative and conversational true crime podcast that deep dives into fascinating criminal cases that are solved, unsolved, or ongoing. From America's Lori Vallow to Germany's Armin Mivas, we examine and discuss the world's most shocking cases. If you're enjoying the show, don't forget to follow us online. Check us out at WeSawTheDevil.com and WeSawTheDevil on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. And don't forget, you can become part of the show by backing us on Patreon. Hello, everyone. You're listening to We Saw the Devil. This is Robin, and I am on my own with this particular episode. Jackie will be returning for our big Lori Vallow update episode that we'll be releasing next week. It is kind of time for one, right? Like an overall state of the case. There hasn't really been much like juiciness or anything, any leaks or big drops on it. Things on that side are relatively quiet. It's just been a lot of legal posturing, lots of filings and motions. So we will be releasing an update episode, basically breaking that all down, what it means and how it's impacting the case. Also, if you guys hear any clicks or knocks behind me, I have two crazy Labradors sitting behind me. And for the life of me, I can't get them to calm down. I mean, we are in a pandemic, so, you know, stuck at home currently. You know how crazy dogs rule, right? You put them in a crate or a little bit of a timeout to get some time, and then they bark and whine and get really upset at you. So they're currently chewing on retriever rolls. Before we get into this episode, let's just get our housekeeping out of the way. Now, you can find us at We Saw the Devil on pretty much every platform known to man, and WeSawTheDevil.com is our website. Don't forget, you can listen to us directly from our website. Our website has a player for every single episode, and you can just click on it and just stream directly from there. If you're loving the show, want to back us, and get some cool perks in return, don't forget to check us out on Patreon at patreon.com/WeSawTheDevil. And don't forget, the most important thing that you can do for this show is to subscribe and head over to iTunes to drop that 5-star review. Reviews help with marketing, charting, and all of those important markers for a podcast that really, truly matter. So we would be forever in your debt. Love you and thank you. If you haven't, check out last week's episode, which is hands down my absolute favorite case that we've covered on this show so far. I mean, I have a kind of personal affinity and favoritism for cannibals. I love those cases, but there is nothing I love more in this world than pissed off badass women who completely turned the tables on a would-be murderer. These two women are absolutely incredible. So, segue. That being said, last week we told the incredible case of Beatrice and Lena and the attack at Salt Creek. The women were two backpackers and they had never met, but they met in an Australian hostel. They became fast friends, they decided to travel together, and then endured and survived a harrowing attack. I mean, it is scary as hell. In that episode, we discussed horror films that took inspiration from Australian serial killers who also killed backpackers. For example, the film Wolf Creek is largely based on Australia's most notorious serial killer, Ivan Milat. In a previous episode, we covered how Scream, the franchise, the movie, the primary villain, Ghostface, is largely based on the Gainesville Ripper, Danny Rawling. And everyone knows that both Psycho and the Texas Chainsaw Massacre are based on the Butcher of Plainfield, Ed Gein. American Psycho's author, Bret Easton Ellis, admitted that he read every single book known to man about Ted Bundy that he could get his hands on while writing the novel. And Bundy is mentioned multiple times, both in the book and the screenplay for American Psycho. And these are just a few films that are loosely based on murderers. If you watch movies, which I mean, I'm sure you probably do, you're undoubtedly familiar with the tried and true tagline, based on a true story. And the films that I've already mentioned skirted around this label. For example, Texas Chainsaw Massacre's tagline was, "What happened is true, now the motion picture that's just as real." not quite true story, but they throw in the based on to just give it a little bit more shock value. Now, the film based on the case that I will be discussing tonight did the exact opposite. With zero, and I mean zero, ambiguity, the film The Town That Dreaded Sundown went all out in embracing it. It doesn't even say based on a true story. In its title poster, it just says true story. That red freaking beacon of like, true story, guys, this is really effed up. Come watch it. And for fellow film nerds like myself, especially those of you who are rabid about horror films like I am, this is one of the founding movies that used the true story title in an effort to be more controversial and provocative. And both the original 1976 film and its 2014 remake do this. The film is about the real-life serial killer known as The Phantom. Now, The Phantom was responsible for a series of murders and later dubbed the Texas Arcana Moonlight Murders, which is probably one of the most beautiful names of all time for something that's so heinous. In less than 3 months, the cities of Texarkana saw 5 dead and 3 wounded in a series of random attacks. These took place primarily on lovers' lanes, but also randomly in a home. It seemed like no one was safe. We've all read about how cities have reacted to killers like the night stalker Richard Ramirez, East Area Rapist, Son of Sam, the Boston Strangler. They essentially paralyzed whole cities in fear. People changed schedules, bought guns, stopped going out, dyed their hair, cut their hair. The cities instated curfews. The film adaptation of The Town That Dreaded Sundown is considered one of the first times that that hysteria, that fear and hysteria was put on film. And from a sociocultural standpoint, that's actually really, really fascinating. That being said, let's get into the case. 1946 in Texarkana. And Texarkana is interesting in itself, and I actually learned a lot while researching this episode. There's a Texarkana, Texas, and then right across the border, there's a Texarkana, Arkansas. And they each have their own police force, mayors, government employees, etc. But both sides, both states, both cities in each of their respective states, they share a federal building, which makes it the only federal building in America to occupy more than one state. It's pretty weird. Texarkana is known as the gateway to the Southwest, and it has always had a reputation for being a bit more rough and tumble. Post-World War II, like when these crimes took place, it was around 1946, it was pretty violent. But in 1946, we're talking post-World War II. Servicemen were returning from war, leaving the military, and life was just starting to resume some sense of normalcy. Coffee shops, cafes, stores, movie theaters, the ones that had been shuttered during the war were all either opening back up or had just opened up. Life was just returning to the town. And now this was greatly aided by the fact that Texarkana was also known as Little Chicago. It was a major railroad shipping hub, which brought business, but also crime and transients. And it's fair to say, again, that Texarkana was a really violent place. It had murders, assaults, muggings, robberies. All of those acts were pretty commonplace on the news. And you have to think, you know, back in the time of Prohibition and everything, Texarkana was one of the main, like, shipping routes for legal alcohol. So you had in Texarkana in particular, a vast group of, like, ne'er-do-wells, basically. That's probably why the first attack by the Phantom killer wasn't taken as seriously. On February 22, 1946, 25-year-old Jimmy Hollis was preparing for a double date with his brother Bob and Bob's girlfriend Virginia. Fresh out of a failed marriage, Jimmy was excited about his date with 19-year-old Mary Jean Levy, who had also gone through a recent divorce. The group went to go see The Strangers at a local theater. Jimmy then drove Bob and Virginia to their homes. Wanting to spend more time with Mary Jean, Jimmy decided to take them out to a lover's lane on the way to drive her home. It was a long, dusty dirt road, roughly 10 miles outside of town, where many of the town's youths would go to get a little privacy with their date, if you know what I'm saying. Instead of me telling the story, I'll just let Mary Jean's own words tell the tale. This is from a months later interview regarding what transpired that evening. Quote, "We had been there about 10 minutes when a man walked up. He wore a white mask over his head with cutout places for his eyes and mouth. He pointed a flashlight and pistol at us. He came up to the driver's side of the car and told Jimmy something like this, 'I don't want to kill you, fellow, so do what I say.' We both got out of the car on Jimmy's side and stood by the man. The man then told Jimmy, quote, 'Take off your fucking britches.' After Jimmy had taken off his trousers, the man hit Jimmy twice on the head. The noise was so loud, I thought Jimmy had been shot. I later learned that the sound was his skull cracking. I picked up Jimmy's pants and took his billfold out of his pocket. I said, 'Look, he doesn't have any money,' but the man told me I was lying and he said that I had a purse, but I told him I didn't. Then he hit me, I thought, with a piece of iron pipe and knocked me to the ground, but I managed to get up. The man told her to take off, and Mary Jean did, but because she was wearing high heels, she was unsteady, stumbling, and not able to run very fast. Now, considering I look like a newborn baby calf in a pair of high heels on a good day, I can't imagine, you know, being threatened, thinking that someone just shot and killed your boyfriend. I can't imagine. So she was falling, unsteady, just like going all over the place. And she saw a car up ahead and she ran, managed to run up to it, but it was empty. She says, just as I got past the car, the man overtook me. The man then hit her on the head with a metal object and attempted to sexually assault her with his gun, the barrel of his gun. During all of this, Jimmy had regained a sense of consciousness, pulled himself up, and ran towards a car on Richmond Road that was driving by, flagging it down. This dirt road led off a main road, and so there were cars going by on the main road. So Jimmy ran over to the main road to try to flag down some traffic. Miraculously, the assailant got off of Mary Jean and fled into the night. As he did, she took off to the first home that she saw and had them alert authorities. Now, as Jimmy was talking to the occupants of the car that he had pulled over, an ambulance arrived. So both Mary Jean and Jimmy were safe. Jimmy and Mary Jean were both taken to the Texarkana Hospital. Jimmy immediately slipped into a coma and was in the hospital for more than 12 days in the ICU, and then an additional, I believe, 15 days for recovery. Mary Jean needed 8 stitches, but was more traumatized than physically injured. Police believed that the approaching car lights likely saved their lives. As the investigation began, police returned to the scene. Nothing. They questioned Mary Jean, but the information that she could provide wouldn't lead them any closer to finding their attacker. The killer had been wearing a white bag over his head with holes cut out for the eyes. That made it difficult for race or any additional identifying features to be observed. Mary Jean did say that she believed that it was a light-skinned African-American male, but that she couldn't be sure. Police erred on the side of caution and didn't release that. Police were actually very skeptical of both Mary Jean and Jimmy, as both were recently divorced. They interviewed their family and friends, and all of them confirmed alibis and stories. They had nothing. Both divorces were completely amicable. For lack of a better saying, no bad blood there. Jimmy eventually awoke from his coma, but didn't have much to add. The entire attack happened so quickly, with a police estimate of just 5 to 8 minutes. In Jimmy's interview, all he had to add was, quote, "I think he was a white man, not over 30 years old, and desperate. That man is dangerous. He's a potential murderer. The next one he gets will be killed. Evidently, he thought he killed me that night. I know he was crazy. The crazy things he said, I know his mind was warped." Police had very little to go on, but the following month, on Sunday, March 24th, they received a call to a brutal scene. A couple discovered the bodies of 29-year-old World War II Navy veteran Richard Griffin and his girlfriend of 6 weeks, 17-year-old Polly Ann Moore, dead inside of Richard's 1941 Oldsmobile sedan on Rich Road, a popular lover's lane. The couple had last been seen the night before eating dinner with Richard's sister on a double date. Richard, Polly Ann, his sister and his sister's boyfriend all went out to dinner, and then Polly Ann dripped some food on her shirt, so Richard had to take her home, and then basically kind of the night just scattered, but their evening ended up at a late night cafe until around 2 a.m. They stopped again at a lover's lane. Both had been shot once in the back of the head. Richard had been shot an additional 2 more times inside the car and was slumped in between the front seats with his head in his hands, and his pockets were turned inside out. His pants were down around his ankles. Polly Ann was face down in the back seat, but there was a nearby blood-soaked blanket on the ground that indicated that she had been murdered there and then placed into the back seat. The weapon, after testing, was determined to have been a .32 caliber Colt revolver. Initially, the passing motorist who drove around believed the couple to be asleep in the car. That is, until they approached the car and saw the gruesome scene within. A crowd had gathered at the site, which tainted the crime scene and prevented police from gathering any potential forensic evidence. What's amazing to me is that the police still believed that these events were isolated and not connected. I mean, how many killers or attackers have you heard of that ask you to take off your pants before they kill you? But I digress, I guess. With a cash reward the equivalent of $6,000 today, over 100 leads poured in from around the community. Unfortunately, each one was a dead end. Just 3 weeks later, on April 14th, police perception would change. This time, the victims were 15-year-old Betty Jo Booker and her friend, 17-year-old Paul Martin. Paul had picked Betty Jo, a saxophonist in her school band, up from a band performance at the local VFW. There was kind of like a school performance slash dance being held there. And that was the last time the pair was seen alive. Paul's body was discovered first around 6:30 a.m. by a couple who was taking a walk, lying on a rural country back road. He had been shot 4 times. In order, first through the nose, then through the left 4th rib from behind, a 3rd time in the right hand, and lastly, through the back of the neck. Because Betty Jo was not present, a search party was dispatched. Betty Jo's body was discovered 5 hours later and more than 2 miles away. She was partially hidden in some woods behind a tree, had been raped, and shot twice. Both had been shot with the same .32 caliber Colt revolver. Whereas the town may have largely overlooked the first attack and double homicide, this one made its impact, which, if it is not crystal clear that a double murder plus a double attack, right? Everybody was like, yeah, that's just another Tuesday night. That kind of describes how raunchy and dangerous Texarkana was in the mid-1940s. However, it was clear now that there was a murderer living among the people of Texarkana, Texas. Hysteria began to set in. People quit their jobs. They changed their schedules. They bought German shepherds and other guard dogs. They created home security systems out of tripwires, pots and pans, hammers, tools. Gun sales more than tripled. And for those more affluent, and this is one of my favorite facts in like the history of true crime, for those who are more affluent, they checked into a large hotel downtown, aptly, and I mean aptly named, the Hotel Grimm. Is there a better name for a hotel that's currently being, like, paralyzed by a serial killer? I don't think so. The Texarkana Gazette then named the killer, gave him a name. In the article, he was given the name The Phantom Killer, obviously due to that white mask. Police began to get hundreds of leads. People calling to report a prowler. I heard something in my backyard, but I need police to come take a look and investigate. Someone's trying to break in. Robberies, home invasions, or just scared calls from residents. anytime something happened, it was basically blamed on the Phantom Killer. However, the city wouldn't have to wait long for tragedy to strike once again. On May 3rd, Virgil and Katie Starks had just finished dinner and were relaxing before going to sleep. Virgil was sitting in his favorite armchair in his living room, reading the newspaper and listening to the radio, and Katie was lying in bed. Katie heard a sound or of movement, like a knock in their backyard. Just as she asked Virgil to turn down the radio, two gunshots tore through the nearby window and struck him in the back of his head. Not understanding what was happening, Katie thought that Virgil had dropped something and rushed out to find him, covered in blood and gurgling, slumped in his chair, dead. She ran to phone the police, but as she grabbed the phone, two more cracks rang out and struck her in the face. The first bullet tore through her right cheek and exited behind her ear. The second entered through her chin, shattered her bottom jaw, ripped out her teeth, and rested right underneath her tongue. She then heard the sound of the metal screen being pulled from her back patio door. Someone was trying to gain entry. Bleeding profusely and choking on her own blood, she made her way through the house. Almost in like a cat and mouse game, she went to the back bedroom. In a later interview, she describes how she thought that she was about to get murdered. So she went to her bedroom to write a note, which, I mean, that wouldn't exactly be my number one instinct, but she went to the bedroom and she heard him making more progress with gaining entry. And so she literally snuck all the way back through their house and out the front door. She ran to the next farm over, which happened to belong to her in-laws. No one was home, so she forced herself to run a half mile more just to find a neighbor who could call police. And in something from the original police report, they actually describe how she was bleeding so profusely that they followed a trail of blood and teeth fragments. During the investigation of the Starks' murder and attack, one piece stood out. The murder weapon was not a .32 caliber Colt. In fact, this particular killer used a .22 caliber rifle. Police also found a red flashlight in the bushes outside of the shot-out window. The bloodied footprints in the house? The second that it tore through her in the kitchen, apparently this is one of the bloodiest crime scenes that police had ever seen. And they were used to seeing, again, Texarkana was called Little Chicago. The bloodied footprints were tainted. Officers who had arrived on scene first walked all over the house, tracking Katie's blood everywhere, ensuring that they couldn't get any sort of shoe print or evidence from that. It was a total bust. Police canines were brought in to potentially track the scent, but it trailed off not far from the farmhouse, so that was a bust. The flashlight itself was sent to the FBI in Washington, D.C., but there was no match there either. It was also a complete dead end. State police were brought into Texarkana to provide assistance with the investigation. They patrolled Lover's Lanes looking for suspicious vehicles. 2 days later, the title on the front page of the Texarkana Gazette on Sunday, May 5th, again, just 2 days after the murder, read, quote, "Sex maniac hunted in murders." And the cash reward kept growing, bolstered by family members of the victims. Virgil Starks' family added another $500. However, money alone doesn't solve cases. By November of 1948, just 2 years later, police no longer believed that Virgil Starks' murder was connected to the others at the Lover's Lanes. In Virgil's case, 12 people were brought in for questioning after almost 500 leads. Only three were further interrogated, but they were all released. The hysteria reached a fever pitch after Virgil and Katie Starks' murder and attempted murder. Police began to use alternate means to entrap the Phantom Killer. They, unfortunately, had to work around citizen sleuths. Everyday residents, they were all going rogue. There was one case where there was a car chase and police pulled the person over, and it was actually a local high school student. And the local high school student was like, "I'm glad, you know, why are you in an unmarked police car? I was about to shoot you." Police were doing traffic stops. In one particular case, the police went to a Lover's Lane to investigate and they saw two people sitting in a car. And so they went over to talk to them. Again, unmarked car. You know, they were detectives. one of the girl in the car was like, I'm so glad that you identified yourself. And the police officer looked inside and she had a gun aimed at him, ready to shoot him. So everyone was completely on edge, and it was just an absolute, the predecessor to Richard Ramirez, Night Stalker, East Area Rapist, just that level of fear that gripped the city. Sometimes the police, when they investigated, they parked at lovers' lanes. Sometimes they put decoys in the cars. Like, they actually would sometimes put mannequins in the cars to sit there, and then they would hang back in a tree line and watch. They even recruited the teenage children of Texas Rangers to be bait, to sit in a car while they were off watching. Unfortunately, the killer never took it. There was one suspect that was happened upon by chance. On June 28, 1946, Officer Max Tackett came across an abandoned stolen car. He did a stakeout, waiting for someone to come back to get it. A woman did, and she was immediately arrested. Her name was Peggy Swinney, and she said that she had just gotten married in Louisiana and that her husband was currently away trying to sell another stolen car to a man in Atlanta, Texas. So Officer Tackett traveled to Atlanta, Texas to meet with that particular citizen, the man who received the stolen car. Thinking that he could use him to draw out Peggy Swinney's husband, he took the man with him to walk around different bustling areas downtown. When the two entered the bus depot of Atlanta, a man booked it and ran out the back. Officer Tackett engaged and gave chase, and he arrested him. It was Ewell Swinney, Peggy's husband, so she was being pretty accurate. Peggy had told police that her husband, Ewell, was, in fact, the phantom killer. She was even able to direct police to various locations where supposed personal effects of previous victims were found. But police were never able to verify the exact links of that hard physical evidence. However, she knew, Peggy knew far too much about the crime scenes, things that were not written in newspapers, things that the everyday citizen should not know. All in all, there was a great deal of circumstantial evidence tying Ewell Swinney to the murders by the phantom killer. However, there was also a lot of evidence saying the exact opposite. Peggy Swinney recanted her confession. Ewell wholeheartedly denied being the phantom. And it was believed that they were in San Antonio on the night of the Griffin Moore murders. Regardless, police, most of them, still believed in their hearts that they had the right person. Ewell was sentenced to life in prison as a habitual offender. He had been arrested many times for stealing cars. It finally caught up to him, and he was sentenced to life in prison. When he was sentenced to prison, all of the killings stopped. Ewell was actually eventually released from prison, and he died in 1994. There have been other multiple suspects since then, but no one has ever been arrested for the crimes. In 1994, the families of the victims received a letter from an anonymous woman apologizing to them for what her father had done to their families. She did not give her name, and it is also not believed that Ewell Swinney ever had children, much less a daughter. Due to the amount of time that has passed, it is highly unlikely that we will ever receive a definitive answer on who the phantom killer is. It's also highly unlikely that the victims' families will ever get closure. However, if you ever find yourself near Texarkana around Halloween, the town that dreaded sundown, the original film, plays in the parks every year. It's the final film played in the Halloween movie nights in the park every single year. It has become tradition. Now, multiple things too. Number one, the film, The Town That Dreaded Sundown, the 1976 version, well, the new one as well, they're largely fictionalized. They actually don't have or hold a lot of truth. In fact, it largely pissed the town off to the point where the director actually got threats and death threats over it, especially since he put that tagline, true story, on the cover and the promotional material of the movie. Number two, urban legend. So I don't know if you guys remember Urban Legend that came out in 1998. I was like finishing up middle school and I actually saw this in theaters. It stars Jared Leto, Rebecca Gayhart, Loretta Devine, Joshua Jackson, Tara Reid, Robert Englund, Daniel Harris. I mean, we have like the whole shebang of 90s actors, right? That is actually supposedly also based on The Town That Dreaded Sundown. Or maybe I Know What You Did Last Summer. So these movies, a lot of them, especially in the mid to late 90s, were based on The Hook or The Hook Man. And that is a story. It was an urban legend about a killer with basically, yeah, it's pretty self-explanatory, a pirate hook for a hand who would attack couples parked in a car. The story of that, the very first known time that that happened, it appeared in an advice column, Dear Abby, in 1960, about a man attacking two lovers parked in a car. So it said that this actually came from, like, all of this stuff was based on the Texarkana Moonlight Murders. And here's the advice column to Dear Abby in 1960. Dear Abby, if you are interested in teenagers, you will print this story. I don't know whether it's true or not, but it doesn't matter because it served its purpose for me. A fellow and his date pulled into their favorite Lover's Lane to listen to the radio and do a little necking. The music was interrupted by an announcer who said there was an escaped convict in the area who had served time for rape and robbery. He was described as having a hook instead of a right hand. The couple became frightened and drove away. When the boy took his girl home, he went around to open the car door for her, then saw a hook in the door handle. I will never park to make out as long as I live. I hope this does the same for other kids. And it's signed Jeanette. I don't know about you guys, but we have all heard that story. I grew up with that story. The scary story is to tell in the dark. There's a version of that story for the 1981 book. There's a movie called Lover's Lane about it. Freaky Stories. Supernatural, the TV show, season 1, episode 7, also features a hook man. It's just inserted itself into pop culture minds and has become this huge thing, and pretty much all based on this series of murders in Texas that were never solved. My last point here, too, that I'll leave you with is, so Yule Swinney, this case was never solved. And like I said, there was a great deal of circumstantial evidence pointing to the fact that he was, in fact, the killer, and then also a few pieces that maybe not. Key pieces being Yule Swinney actually did, in fact, own a .32 caliber Colt automatic, but sold it in a game roughly around the time someone killed the Starks with a then .22 caliber rifle. In the front pocket of his work shirt, a particular slag was found, which is basically the metal that comes off from when you're welding. Virgil Starks was a farmer and a welder. He had a welding shop, and the slag, that material, did in fact match samples found in Virgil Starks' shop. When he was accused of murder, Yule Swinney remained silent instead of actually saying, hey, no, I didn't do that. A detective in the case, who actually investigated the entire series, later went on to say that he 100% believed Yule Swinney to be the phantom killer, and that in order to save his life, because the murders would have been death penalty, immediate death penalty, he would have gotten the chair, hanging, he would have been sentenced to death. So the detective, way later on, wrote about this and said, no, what happened, it was actually kind of like a backdoor plea deal. He didn't want to die, so he just accepted the fact that he would be sentenced to life and have to endure a jury trial, basically so he wouldn't be put to death. That was never made official, though. So at the end of the day, no one knows. So this is currently listed as an unsolved crime. So that is it, guys. That is it for The Town That Dreaded Sundown. If you're interested in the film, the 2014 remake is pretty interesting, but the 1976 original is really interesting, again, in how it portrays that hysteria. Elements of 70s exploitation film, horror slasher films. If you're into horror movies, Town That Dreaded Sundown is actually considered one of the very first quote-unquote slasher films. But the way that they portray people locking their doors and, you know, it's what we currently imagine and a lot of people older than me have experienced based on, you know, certain cities and certain cases. But that is it for this case. So what cases can you think of that have kind of eat themselves so deeply into public consciousness. Can you think of other true crime cases that have had that much of an impact? John Wayne Gacy created kind of the clown hysteria that we've seen. I mean, clowns have been creepy for a hell of a long time, but he definitely did not help that case at all. So yeah, if you're listening to us on YouTube or you're on our Facebook page or Facebook group, drop us a comment. I want to know what cases you think have made this large of an impact on either pop culture or American culture in general. So again, guys, thank you so much for listening. Again, you can find us on every single social media outlet as We Saw the Devil, our website, wesawthedevil.com, and Patreon. That's patreon.com/wesawthedevil. And we will see you next week with a Lori Vallow State of the Case update. Until next crime.